I think once we get going, we'll find you and I could probably chat for a couple of years.
Always.
So,
if we only had a pizza here to share.
Oh, well, we'll talk about it. I made one last night on purpose. I'm not going to thing in my throat. So we'll talk about that when we get in there. But I made it last night in a cast iron pan because that's what I had. Oh, my God. The family, they loved it. And I make pizza a lot, but I use it on the screen.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, pizza on the screen, there's nothing wrong with it. If you make a good crust, it's fine. Yeah. It's a way you can respond quickly to feeding people, whereas Detroit pizza, you got to be a little bit more planning. But
also with the advantage of baking in the pan, of course, is you get that oil frying the bottom of your crust, is part of the transcendent quality.
The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 38.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Head on over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts. And there you can click the link to join my Eating Liberty Facebook group. You can also follow me on Minds and bitbacker.io and Gab and Twitter, as well as subscribe to my YouTube cooking show, well, you know, so to speak. A few more items. Please do continue to support the show with the links on the podcast's page, also with your patronage at, well, Patreon, Bitcoin, and PayPal. Also, when you listen to the show on your favorite podcatcher, rate the show, and please do give a positive review. Those quick steps help move the show up and let more people find it. And the more people who find it are the more people who get cooking. You can also support the show and make a yummy treat for yourself by picking up my Muffins e-cookbook. Just leave me your email address and download the book, and for that, I'll send you a couple of emails a week or so. As school is winding down, it is almost certain the kids will read next to nothing, or read something so far below the reading level it may as well be nothing. You can fix the problem and the summer memory vacuum with books from the Tuttle Twins series. Creator and writer and parent, Connor Boyack, knows well the problem of finding good content for kids. Connor writes on his webpage, "I've been in your shoes, so I wrote a series of books to teach your kids what their schools no longer do." Each Tuttle Twins book is a classic work made accessible to kids and includes titles such as Basquiat's The Law, Reed's Eye Pencil, as well as Gatto's Themes on Education and a book about the Golden Rule. Connor also offers workbook companions, and if you buy the set of 10, the workbooks are free. Keep your kids reading and interested in reading this summer. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/Tuttle Twins. That's culinarylibertarian.com/TuttleTwins, or click the banner on today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/38. My guest today is Peter Reinhardt, baking instructor at Johnson & Wales University and baking cookbook author. Peter has written 12 books, including The Baker's Apprentice, which won the James Beard Award for books in 2002. Three other of Peter's books have won the Gourmand International Cookbook Award, and Peter himself won the 1996 James Beard National Bread Competition for his Wild Yeast Country Bread. He has a new book, Perfect Pan Pizza, Square Pies to Make at Home, from Roman, Sicilian, and Detroit to Grandma Pies and Focaccia, which was released in May. Peter doesn't know it yet, but he was instrumental in my baking education, being one of two authors in whom I put my trust.
Welcome, Peter. Thank you for joining me on the Culinary Libertarian Show today.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Before we get going into the background, and I realize that your background is at least two books worth of information, but for people who don't know who you are, we'll get into a little bit of how you got into baking and teaching. I want to take a moment to tell you that for me, Bread Upon the Waters may be the most spiritually moving and fulfilling book I've ever read since Jane Roberts' Seth series. And I think from your early days of religious exploration, you probably know who that is. So
I'm trying to remember. I mean, if I ever read any of that series, it was so long ago. But I'm writing it down because now I've got to look it up. But my God, I'm thrilled and honored to hear you say that that the book worked for you, because of all the books that I've written, it's the one that has sold the least number of copies.
It's too bad, because it's just a magnificent work. And so Jane Roberts hung out at the time with Richard Bach, and you know who that is. Well, good luck. I mean, she's worth finding. It's interesting, but really this is also just to give you a very sincere thank you, because it's a spectacular book.
Well, thank you. I'm honored.
So just a double ride elevator pitch about your background and how you came to be into baking and teaching, for people who don't know who Peter Reinhardt is.
Well, I'll try to see if I can do this in just a concise way. So this is the Reader's Digest version, I guess. I was a college major and majoring in film studies and broadcasting, with a goal to be a writer, a film writer and director. But about three quarters of the way through the process, I realized that, number one, I wasn't really ready for college. I felt like I had the skills, and I knew that I could write. But I just didn't know what I wanted to write about. I didn't feel like I had something that I could write about. And I turned down a couple of good entree jobs in the industry to work with pretty big name directors like Otto Preminger, because I felt like if I had gone into the film business before I was ready, it would gobble me up. It would chew me up and just destroy me. And of course, this was the late 60s, early 70s, when, you know, there was a lot of social turmoil. There was consciousness issues. There was hallucinogenics, all sorts of things going around, a lot of spiritual seeking. And so I decided to leave college and kind of go on a journey of self-discovery, figure out who I was and what I had to say. And the first stop in that journey was I fell in with a group of people that I guess you could just call them hippies, who were getting ready to open a organic vegetarian restaurant in Boston, where I was in school. And I decided to hang out with them. And even though I didn't know how to cook, I started to help them. We were getting the facility ready. We were, you know, sanding chairs and painting. And finally, we opened. And only a couple people really knew how to cook. We had some good vegetarian recipes. And we had a vision of organic food that really didn't exist at that time in the East Coast. And we opened. And I started out just helping out and washing dishes, and little by little started to cook. And every day we'd volunteer for different dishes on the menu. And within 6 to 8 months, I discovered that I liked cooking so much that I was a fast learner. And before long, I was cooking half the menu and sharing the rest of the menu with other people on the staff. And before long, I was essentially the kitchen manager. And that's where I discovered how much I loved to cook. And also, while we made easy breads like banana bread and carrot breads and things like that, we didn't make our sandwich breads there. We had those made for us by another hippie operation around the corner that was doing like organic whole grain breads with natural starters, which was also very rare at that time. And so I would sometimes go over and watch them bake the bread, and I became fascinated with that process, but wasn't in a position to do anything about it until a few years later. So I'll fast forward, and in a few years we decided, as our sort of our own individual spiritual journeys began to unfold, all of us found next steps that opened up for us. And for me, the next step was to become a brother in a Christian service order. It was a non-denominational order, but the order, it was called the Holy Order of Mans. It existed, started around 1968. It was kind of a hybrid. It borrowed from a lot of traditions, both Eastern religions, Catholicism, mystical groups like Rosicrucian. It had a little bit of everything. It was kind of a, like I say, a hybrid, but it was attracting people because there was something, there was a spirit in it that was compelling. And it was answering a lot of the questions that I had begun to and ask and find answers for through meditation and yoga and Zen Buddhism, everything. But I, this particular group kind of brought them all together for me in a Western articulation. And the last place I expected to end up was in a Christian group because I was raised Jewish. But I, you know, kind of continued on with them for a while, going to classes without necessarily committing to it. But after a while, I realized this was the path for me, the next step in my life. And so I actually became a brother. And for the next 20 years, I was known as Brother Peter. And I was in this brotherhood called the Holy Order of Mans, which later in the story realized that we had gone as far as we could as an independent, non-affiliated sort of group of ragtag seekers and needed to anchor ourselves in something more traditional and solid. We were claiming that we had a priesthood and that, you know, we could sort of self-ordain ourselves. And we realized that that was really a little bit presumptuous. And so we started a deep study into the history of the Christian tradition to see where we fit in that tradition. And eventually we realized, having worked our way back from modern times all the way back to the origin days, that where the theology and philosophy that was driving us was found was in the original Eastern Orthodox Christianity, what they call the mystical tradition of Eastern Orthodoxy, which is Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Antiochian. There's different jurisdictions of Orthodoxy, but that ran parallel to the Catholic tradition, which was basically the Western branch of Orthodoxy until they split from each other about 1,000 years ago. But the Eastern Church was where we felt that we really were already kind of on a, had discovered a lot of those teachings on our own, and we needed to ally ourselves with that. And so we formally petitioned, and this is, goes back to around 1986, to enter as an organization, as a brotherhood, enter into the Eastern Orthodox Church. That took a little bit of time to navigate all those, you know, travels and to kind of figure out what we were going to, what we had to jettison from our earlier days and what we could, you know, kind of embrace. We got rebaptized and essentially started over. But with this 20, by that time I'd been involved for 12, 13 years and had a pretty strong foundation, but now we had a whole new treasure chest to tap into. So since 1986, I've been in the Eastern Orthodox Church, continued my journey. Along that way, I got married. We had marriage in our community. My wife was a sister in the brotherhood. And so she also was a very good cook. We both knew how to cook because I'd been cooking in the restaurant earlier. I cooked a lot in our seminaries. And we decided to open a cafe in the town where we were living, which was Forestville, California, along the Russian River, which was the headquarters of our organization. And we opened a cafe called Brother Juniper's Cafe and Bakery. And part of the idea was we'd make all our own food. It was kind of a little test kitchen for food ideas that we had that possibly could support a community of people, and bake bread, because I had over the years re-energized myself in the bread realm and started to fall in love with bread making. And I taught myself how to do it, started to study some techniques. And first thing that kind of was a breakthrough was making Julia Child's 12-page instructions for how to do baguettes. And once I made baguettes and everybody flipped out over them, I was hooked forever. And then later on, I developed a recipe for a traditional Scottish bread called Struan, which is a harvest bread associated with the Michaelmas festival of Celtic Christianity. Christianity in general has a harvest festival, you know, dedicated to Michael the Archangel, and so we call it Michaelmas. And the Scottish version was the way they celebrated it in the Isles of Scotland. And this bread Struan had a great backstory and lots of interesting sort of mythic qualities to it. So I decided to make my own version. And after a couple of years of playing with it, right about the time we decided to open our restaurant, I decided to make that the centerpiece bread in our you know, arsenal of breads that we were going to make in-house. And that Sturm bread became the, I guess you'd say, the flagship bread of what later became Brother Juniper's Bakery. And still to this day, many years later, still the my most favorite bread, the bread I think that most clearly defines me, who I am. It's almost like a metaphor of my own journey. The word Struan itself actually means the convergence of streams, the opposite of like a French bread, which has four ingredients. The Struan bread, the harvest bread, has about 12 ingredients. And I kind of realized at that point that one of the reasons why I love this bread, is aside from the fact that it makes the best toast you've ever had, is that it kind of embodies me. I myself, I'm a convergence of many streams, and it, and I just identified with it so closely that I have a, an emotional connection that, you know, makes it always my number one go-to bread. And beyond that, we eventually, we built it up. We sold the bakery and the restaurant. The brotherhood by that point had gone somewhat scattered. We were no longer centralized and everybody went off on their own. We no longer lived together in a semi-monastic setting, but we went, everyone was kind of on their own financially. We had the bakery for a while and the restaurant to support us, but it wasn't what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. It wasn't my mission. I felt like my personal mission was teaching and writing. By then I had published my first book, Brother Juniper's Bread Book, and had just come out with my second book, which was called Sacramental Magic in a Small Town Cafe, which was recipes and stories from Brother Juniper's, and was working on my next book, which was the book that came out. Actually, it didn't come out third, but it was the third book I worked on, called Bread Upon the Waters, which you've already mentioned. And so all of a sudden I realized that I finally had something to write about. After all these years of, you know, leaving the film opportunities behind, that I finally knew what I had to write about. Bread became the guiding metaphor of my writings. And I've been following that ever since. The books led to teaching opportunities and I became a culinary instructor in San Francisco at the California Culinary Institute for 5 years. And then Johnson & Wales invited me to become part of the faculty in Rhode Island at Providence's campus, the original Johnson & Wales campus. And we, my wife Susan and I, decided to move back east from California because our families were all back there. It was the right time, the right job. And I've been with Johnson & Wales. This year is my 20th year with Johnson & Wales. But 4 years into the process, they announced that they were going to open a campus in Charlotte, North Carolina. Susan's family had moved to the Carolinas. I had lived in the Carolinas during my missionary days, and I loved it. And so we decided to jump on the Carolina wagon, and I've been here now for the last 15 years. And that brings us to the present moment. In between, I just kept writing books, and now I'm up to my 12th book.
Fabulous. Well, the Carolinas are beautiful. My sister lives in the Carolinas, and I've lived there as well. So good for you. And one of the things that comes through very clearly in your writings that I've read, and I sort of found you, I went in sort of weird order. I found you when The Baker's Apprentice was very popular. And I started as a cook, and most cooks can't and won't bake. There are two different disciplines, and you've already figured this out, but cooks generally like to have this sort of just this heat and fire and Tim Allen and And there's a kind of discipline to cooking, but there's a very different kind of discipline to baking, even something as simple as a muffin. And you can't bully it around. So I think cooks tend to avoid baking. But I didn't have this, but that book and another one were really instrumental. So this is the thing you don't know, was even though we've never met until now we're talking, for many, many years you were my trusted source for what bread should be. And I got better because of that. And that's mostly due to The Baker's Apprentice. Although I will say, the assembling of bread, man, oh, man, oh, man, that kicked my butt.
Really? Have you mastered it yet, or are we still working on it?
I haven't. We tried and tried and tried and tried. And
we'll carry on after this conversation with a little back and forth to get you to the perfect version of the semolina brand. We call it Pane Siciliano in the book, and I love it. So I'll get you there.
Well, at the time, one of my cooks was from New Jersey and said, "Oh, I know this bread." So we tried and we tried and we tried. Well, that one eluded us, but I have since. I have made your focaccia my own, and we did your ciabattas there at the restaurant, and talk about, you know, move your hands faster than the dough sticks.
Where was the restaurant?
It was in Tallahassee.
Oh, all right. Yeah, and it's hard to do bread in the Florida area because of the heat and humidity. It's hard to control it. You can do it. It's just that you have different issues with fermentation times.
Oh my gosh, so many problems. So you mentioned about the emotional connection was something that really resonates to me in your writings, especially because through Brother Juniper and Bread Upon the Waters, but also in The Apprentice, and then also now in your new Perfect Pan Pizza book. And one of the things that I think this might be a bigger thing, I think that there's a lot of people for whom, or to whom, if you say, if you wax reminiscent and fondly about the sound of a baguette cracking as it's cooling, I think a lot of people will look at you like, "Yeah, okay, I need to go. Sorry, gotta go now," and that's okay. And so I had at this same Tallahassee restaurant, I had learned where we started this baking breads really in earnest was also in Tallahassee, the other end of the block. I worked for a certified master chef, and we really, really, really pushed on doing traditional Levain style sourdough rise and other things because we had to have sandwiches, and so we couldn't just be all frou-frou. But that's where the appreciation came. And so teaching my cooks at this other place, I said to these young guys, I said, "Listen, when you're pulling this bread out and it starts to crack, this is the bread talking back to you.
Right.
What the bread says is, I love you too. And it's saying that because it's thanking you for making and baking the bread the right way." And they thought, this guy is just off his nut.
Yeah, that's the point where they say to you, "You're not going to expect me to hug you right now, are you?"
Well, if you can if you want to, but no, that wasn't a part of the thing. And I know you're joking, but you know, you give someone who's interested in baking that opportunity, and if they have an artist's spirit. And this one fellow was a musician, so he had that he had that ability to appreciate craft, and he got it. It clicked and said, "Oh my gosh, yeah. I understand."
Yeah, yeah, and exactly. And it is true when you tap into when it happens to you, it can kind of like circumvent all those other preconceptions that you have about, you know, how you're supposed to be with this stuff. It touches you emotionally for sure.
So it isn't really a problem, but it's one of those kinds of transformations from which there is no return. Once you've crossed over into bread appreciation, then that's it. Now, and then suddenly things, commercial bread becomes almost insufferable.
Right, right. It kind of ruins you for bread.
It kind of does. And so I've got kids. And so sometimes I make a variety of loaves, partly because I can pronounce the ingredients in the loaves and I can control them, but I don't want to buy that anymore because it's, even if it's a soft crusted bread for a sandwich, I want to have more control over what I'm doing. So,
Well, I'm glad you said that because I think what you described also is kind of the arc of the artisan bread movement over the last 20 years in America. Whereas, you know, prior to the 1990s, there was very little good bread in the United States. We were almost, you know, like mocked by the rest of the bread world for having horrible bread or mediocre bread at best. And it wasn't until people would say, go to France or go to Germany or someplace where they made good bread, that they would come back and go, wow, I finally know what real bread is. And then one by one, these little bakeries started popping up. Most of them were inspired by the advent of the Bread Bakers Guild of America in the early 90s, which brought a lot of master bakers over here to teach us their techniques and to share this, the methods that they were using. And all of a sudden, there were artisan bakeries popping up around the country, changing the palate of their customers and Americans to where the expectation was raised, the bar was raised, and little by little, more and more people got to that point you just described of not being willing to settle for just average so-so product anymore. And it has tipped over. It probably tipped over around in the early 2000s. And then, of course, there were challenges to bread with the gluten-free movement and the low-carb movements and all those things. And yet bread keeps reemerging because it's so deeply embedded in our psyches and in our souls and so primal to us that it's the hardest thing to give up, much harder to give up bread than it is to give up meat or, you know, some other food or, you know, that you might have a problem with, because people just love their bread.
Yes, I agree.
So anyway, that and that parallel, I think, just that little arc I was describing, we've seen it paralleled in the craft beer movement as well.
Oh,
and very much the same thing, because really, you know, beer is just liquid bread when you think about it, and bread is solid beer. And so the arc is similar. And this happened in the United States over 100 years ago in the late 1800s, when there were many craft breweries around the country who were then little by little, you know, gobbled up by a few of the big guys. And then it all got kind of down into like three or four major breweries. And then finally it burst out of that shell back, you know, maybe 15 years ago, started on the heels of the bread movement. And now the pizza movement is another iteration of that same kind of breathing pattern of going from good pizza. The pizza makers have been informed and influenced by the artisan bread makers. The palate of America has changed. People have higher expectations, and it's no longer acceptable to just make an average product. People want to be able to make the exceptional, extraordinary product because their customers really demand it. And it's kind of a cool thing to watch this thing unfold. It happened with wine also, I guess you could say, even before it happened with beer. So there's so many parallels. And for me, of course, the path that I've been on as a bread maker, you know, I've been able to tell that story. But I'm watching with amusement the same story unfold in these other areas of artisanship and craft.
Right. Yeah, beer and bread. I actually probably stole it from you, but the beer is beer and bread being almost the same. The thing about bread, and you touch on this, and I want to just get back to this and see about your feeling with your students. I don't want to assume too much. I want to be sort of disrespectful, but there is almost the symbolic creation of life in making a loaf of bread. You're starting with nothing. And you're making this thing, which, for intents and purposes, it's representing a life, and so there is very strong mythological connections and symbolical connections.
Yeah. Well, you nailed it. You know exactly. I think that is the defining quality of why bread and other fermented foods, you know, beer, cheese, you know, but especially bread. That the fact that you're bringing something to life, you know, you've taken the life from the wheat. And now you're transforming it back into something new and living. That does work on us very subconsciously, very subliminally, but maybe also very soulfully. And even if you're not thinking about it, very few people do think about it, but it's still working on us because that's pretty profound.
Yes. So one of my questions is, and I think your experience with your students would inform this answer, does one need to have an appreciation of that happening to excel at being a baker? Or can, say, the engineer who sees more the assembly of a product into the gestalt of the finished thing,
right,
that doesn't necessarily preclude that person from being a great baker. So how do you teach this?
Well,
can you teach this to someone who doesn't get it?
Well, actually, as you're saying that, it reminded me of something I read years ago in a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
With Richard Bach and with Jane Roberts.
Yeah, exactly. And that book was one of those books that was very popular, sold a lot of copies, but very few people actually read it from cover to cover because it was not an easy read. Because it was really about sort of an emotional breakdown of a guy. And through kind of his motorcycle, kind of brought him back to life. But in that book, he described that there are two kinds of motorcycle people. They're the ones who love getting so-called under the hood. They love to take it apart and clean it and fine tune it. And they're really mechanically oriented. And then there are the people who just like to get on the motorcycle and ride and let their hair, flow in the wind. And it's kind of the more romantic aspect of motorcycle maintenance. And both of those are legitimate and valid in their own rights. And some people are more prone towards one side or the other. And some people embrace both of those aspects. And I find that for me, with bread baking, it's similar in the sense that there is the nuts and bolts aspect. And you can make great bread without having to think about it philosophically or mystically or, symbolically. It's a very literally an easy thing to learn how to do. And many bakers, majority of bakers, make great bread without having to think about those things at all, because they know that if they do A plus B plus C plus C, it equals great bread. I think that to peel back the layers to a little bit, deeper realm, just enhances your appreciation. So, and again, I'll reference an old teaching that was popularized in the about 1,000 years ago during the scholastic period of Christianity. And it was articulated in a writing by Dante Alighieri, in which he described that there are four levels of understanding the meaning of all things, and everything exists on four levels. Many spiritual traditions have different ways of saying this. They may say seven levels of meaning or three levels of it, but he said four, and I like these four. And the first one being the literal level, in which, it's just literally the truth of that level, such as, mixing your dough and shaping it and baking it. The next level down is what he called the metaphorical or poetic level, in which things exist at this poetic symbolic level. A deeper level even than that, he said, was the philosophical level, in which you kind of break it down into like first principles, and it exists. And you don't break it down, but it exists on these other levels of universal principles. And then he said at the deepest level of all is what they call the mystical level, or the term they used was anagogical, the anagogical level of understanding. He says, but the key to all of this is you cannot access the three deeper levels until you first go through the literal level. You must go through the literal to understand the deeper. And so I think that for me, I only have kind of come to these kinds of thoughts because I was making bread and not really thinking about it in any kind of symbolic or spiritual sense, but just simply in the literal sense of making bread. But after years of making it and then having a few insights here and there, and my first book was based on the single insight that slow rising bread is better tasting than fast rising bread. That was the insight. And that led to the idea of, I think the title was Brother Juniper's Bread Book, subtitle, Slow Rise as Method and Metaphor. And that's when I began to think of bread making and bread as a metaphor beyond just the literal level of a loaf of bread. And then reporters would ask me in interviews what it was about bread that made it so special to people. Why does it have this sort of special place in so many people's hearts? And it was only in trying to answer those questions for the reporters that I began to go deeper and deeper, and little by little uncovered some of these other teachings like the four levels of meaning. All this kind of came afterwards. And so for me, all that did, or what it mainly did, was it totally enhanced my understanding and appreciation of bread and allowed it to have more meaning than ever in my life, and have something to be able to write about and talk about and use as a way to help other people sort of understand, again, not just how to make bread, but sort of the purpose of life. Because, with my background in ministry, everything I do really is not about the literal thing that I'm writing about, but it's about the deeper level of the meaning and purpose of life. Finding a meaningful life is really the theme of all my writings. And it wasn't until I kind of started to peel these onion layers back to see these deeper levels that I actually felt like I had something to share. So, but going back to your original question, no, I don't think that you have to even think about these things. You don't have to be religious. You don't have to be spiritual. You don't have to have, you know, you don't have to be poetic to be able to make great bread. Anybody can do it. And then sometimes it will touch you in a way that opens you up to deeper levels.
Hmm. Well, your observation about, and the title was right, Slow Rise is Method and Metaphor. And in Bread Upon the Waters and Brother Juniper, one of the, it isn't even cloaked. The metaphor is slow rise of the bread, creating a better bread is the slow rise of the person makes a better person. And you're very plain about that in Bread Upon the Waters. But that's,
there you go, yeah.
I like that part. And that, and there's a connection to me that, you know, authors try, this is sort of the Proustian moment, you sort of try to create that perfect thing that 40 years from now, someone's going to remember.
Yeah.
And there's just something in the way you write that I connect with. And this is the thing readers look for, is they look for the author's like, oh my gosh. You know, it's bordering on almost silliness. And I don't mean to make it silly because it's not to be made light of, but this is a big deal. And I'm impressed with your work. So,
well, thank you. Well, you know, I think what you're describing is what I call an epiphany, you know, that, and we all, and what a good writer can do, and I'm trying to be a good writer. I'm getting better and better as I do it more often. But I think what the challenge of a good writer or artist of any sort is to create something that touches a person so that they have their own epiphanies, that they're not just vicariously having your epiphany. Your epiphany may have sparked what you're writing or creating, but you haven't completed the circle until the person you're communicating with has their own aha moment. And you've described a number of aha moments that you've had, you know, in your own journey. And that gives me the most joy because that means that I've, you know, that gives me a sense of fulfillment that I've touched somebody in a way that's helped them to have their own ahas.
Well, yes, sir. Well done. I'm going to go to the idea of the increased awareness and desire for artisanal products. And we're going to keep it focused mostly on, I mean, beer and wine, yes, but on bread mostly and food in general. And we've already decided that anybody can do it. It's kind of like that movie Ratatouille. Anybody can cook. You make the observation about Escoffier. Cooking is taking an ingredient and doing something to it. Anybody can do that. Escoffier says great cooking is taking that and then doing something else to it.
Yeah.
And that's where we're going to lose a few people.
Right.
And that's okay. So one of the things that I'm sort of working on my blog and on this podcast is I think a lot of people go out to a really good restaurant and that sets the bar for them about what this particular dish ought to be. Then they go home and they want to try and recreate it and they're probably not going to do it because what they don't know is behind the scenes, through that wall, is a dozen sets of hands, an incredible amount of equipment and time and labor and access to things that nobody at home has. So it's an unrealistic expectation that you're going right. to go and recreate a meal from Boulay or from Le Cirque or Spago. I think we need to change our expectation.
Right.
You know, not everyone's LeBron James. Not everyone is Cyril Heights. We can't just go and do this stuff, but let's change our expectation so now we can have success that we're proud of. And that's where home baking and home cooking becomes more successful than not, because you know, and I got people say, I told you I can't bake.
Right.
Well,
right.
Okay. Let's start. Change the expectation, then change the result.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's a good point. I mean, first of all, you know, I, as a culinary school teacher, we see a lot of students who come in who want to be great cooks and they maybe are good cooks and then they think about wanting to have a restaurant. And for some of those kids, you know that that the joy that they have in cooking and learning about cooking might be extinguished if they go into the restaurant business because it could destroy them if they're not really ready for that. They say that, you know, the people that make great home cooking and their friends say, you ought to open a restaurant. You're so good at it. And then they finally do open a restaurant and then they stop loving the cooking process because they get overwhelmed by the burden of running a business. So it's a tricky balance. It's not for everybody. And then to master something, you know, the 10,000 hours that Malcolm Gladwell talks about that it takes to be good at anything. That's a lot of hours, and it takes a lot of practice. And as even with me, you know, bread making, I've been doing it now professionally for 30 years, but I'm still constantly feeling like there's still more to learn, and I haven't mastered it. Every once in a while, I make a great loaf. I have plenty of failures. I have breads that, you know, don't meet my highest expectations. It's humbling. It's humbling to do any craft, and to do it and repeat it over and over and over again. Imagine all the shots that Michael Jordan and LeBron James have missed to get to the point where they can make as many as they made.
No, exactly.
They have resilience to get through that.
True enough. True enough. All right. So let's talk a little bit about your new book, Perfect Pan Pizza. It is a stunning book. It is just gorgeous. I was so impressed by that when I looked at it. I was like, this is... So I was very excited about it because the pictures are beautiful.
Thank you so much. Yeah, our photographer and his wife, who was a food stylist, worked together as a team. It's the first time we've done a book together, and it was a joy to work with them.
Well, they've done great work because the pictures, you just want to eat the pictures. They're just, you know, and everyone said that, but I'm telling you, it's like, this is really, really well done. So good job on all that front.
Great, thank you.
So one of the things, now you make a comment about this in the book, but I want you to talk about it. I am from Detroit. And when I was a kid, it was just pizza.
Right.
So I had to go to Oregon to find out that Detroit pizza is a thing. So
yeah.
Tell us about Detroit pizza.
Detroit pizza is, well, you're right. In Detroit, it's pizza. Detroit pizza is just pizza. And so we have to kind of go back a step. What is pizza? and for me, the definition of pizza is dough with something on it. It's as simple as that. So if pizza is just dough with something on it, you know, what is it that distinguishes good pizza, of which 99% of the pizza that's made in this country is good. It works. Pizza is a perfect food. It always delivers flavor, which is the ultimate goal of food, is to deliver flavor. And pizza is the perfect flavor delivery system, even when it's done at an average level. And I know this is true because look at all the frozen pizzas that are consumed every day, and the takeout pizzas and the fast stuff that is okay, but it's not great. And so then I had to say, okay, what is the difference between good and great, of which there's only maybe 1% of the pizzas. Maybe it's grown to 2% in the last few years because this category is growing and improving. And finally, I came up with, after writing a book 15 years ago called American Pie, My Search for the Perfect Pizza, I came to a couple conclusions, one being that the definition of greatness boils down to one thing. Is it memorable? Greatness is defined for me as by something that you've done or eaten or experience you've had that is memorable. It's burned into your memory, into your consciousness in a way that creates a benchmark for other experiences. So pizzas that are memorable become the standard by which, just like the bread you were describing, become the standards by which all of the pizzas afterwards are judged and gauged. And there's certain ones that you just know it when you experience it. This has become a new benchmark for me. It is memorable. And now there, you know, I may have in my mind as many as 20 places that I can think of that produce memorable pizza. But when I wrote the first book, there were only a few of them out there that were really famous and had passed the test of time or the test of passion of people, you know, kind of accepting the consensus being this is a great pizzeria. Some have been around for a long time, like Frank Pepe's in New Haven, and some were newer. That's the beginning of the conversation, is what makes them great. And what makes pizza great is the fact that dough with something on it is the perfect way to deliver flavor. And then after that, it's all about, okay, what are the flavors we're delivering? And again, another corollary or a kind of a principle that I go by is that what makes a pizza memorable is the crust. It starts with the crust, not the toppings. Cheese and sauce are almost like the bonus ingredients. That's part of what the flavor being conveyed to you, but it's being conveyed to you on a crust that can either, you know, like rock your world or just be a crust that then sort of shifts all the attention to the toppings. When the crust is great, you have a chance to create a memorable pizza experience. If the crust is just average, then it doesn't matter how great the toppings are on top. The best you can hope for is a good and interesting pizza, but not one that becomes seared into your memory as memorable. And so when I looked at all the pizzas that I found that sort of did it for me, that rocked me, it was always a great crust was involved there. And being a bread guy, of course, that spoke to my wheelhouse. And I started looking for places and trying to find what it is that the places and people that were creating those kinds of pizzas were doing that other people weren't doing that differentiated the great ones from just the good ones. And so then, you know, when I wrote that book, Detroit pizza wasn't even on my radar because it was still kind of a secret of Detroit. This pizza baked in a square pan was Detroit's little secret. And people moved away from Detroit, knew about it, but it really wasn't a thing yet. There were other square type pizzas. There's focaccia. There's pizzas that are made in St. Louis that have their style. There's so many different styles of pizza, but I didn't really tune in to the Detroit thing until a few years ago. And all of a sudden, I started judging pizza competitions at the pizza expos and the various conventions. And it started out with most of the focus being on wood-fired Neapolitan-style pizzas because that's the hot thing right now. And we also had a category for traditional American-style or slash New York-style pizzas that are sort of the Americanized version of Neapolitan pizza. And then they had to create a new category because more and more people were entering pizzas in what they called the non-traditional category, meaning anything goes. And the ones that kept coming up over and over again were these square pizzas with a thicker crust that they were being referred to as Detroit pizzas. So, of course, then I started to look into all that and figure out, you know, where that all came from. And it's got a great origin story in Detroit with, you know, this guy Gus, you know, who worked in the auto industry, who walked out when he retired with tons of these blue steel pans that were used to hold nuts and bolts in the manufacturing facilities, and he started baking pizzas in them. And little by little, that's, you know, he kind of perfected that style, and other people copied him, and a couple generations have gone by, and a few of these pizzerias, one of them being Jets, I think Jets was the first to break out of Detroit and sort of franchise the idea. And then, you know, little by little, some of the other ones did, and then other chefs started to catch on to it. And in New York City, a pizzeria called Emmy Squared opened, and they called Squared for the square pizza. There's one in Chicago doing square pizzas, and they may not call them Detroit style, but they're all inspired by this Detroit style. And so then again, okay, what is it about this pizza that makes it so special? Because when I had that pizza and I experienced it and I went, whoa, there's something special going on here. I didn't know there was a pizza of this caliber, you know, and of this style. And now I need to find out what it is and how I can make the best version of it. And so getting back to what makes it unique and special is that because it is baked in a pan, you can use a little bit wetter stick of your dough and spread it out like you could do like a focaccia. And the pan is oiled, and the oil will actually bake into and fry the bottom of the crust, creating a texture very similar to hot buttered toast. I think of it as like toffee. It kind of shatters when you bite into it, and the shards of the crust, you know, kind of break apart in your mouth, and you get this, all I can describe it as, is a delightful pleasure that I associate with hot, great hot buttered toast. And we're seeing a lot of toasting cafes. People are into toast again. Well, toast and Detroit style pizza are very, very similar. So that's on the bottom. Then to top it off, on the side of the pizza, well, not to top it off, but to add to this, on the side of the pizza, in this style of pizza, so the cheese, some of the cheese is put all the way around the edge. And as it bakes, the cheese melts not only on top, but down the side of the pizza and bakes on the edge of the crust, which is usually about an inch to an inch and a half thick. It's not thin like an American style or Neapolitan style pizza, but it gets this crispy cheese edge around the outer edge of the pizza, which is sometimes referred to as a frico. F-R-I-C-O, a frico, which is just basically like a thin cheese wafer. it's that having a frico is not going to make the pizza memorable, but it's sort of part of the gestalt of the pizza. It gives it this special little bonus factor. And then on top, the Detroit style pizzas often are made with either brick cheese, which is a Wisconsin type cheese, which is hard to find for home bakers, or a combination of mozzarella and cheddar and possibly fontina, provolone, different kinds of cheeses that melt really, really good. And there's quite a bit put on top. So you get, it's kind of the opposite of a Neapolitan pizza, which is more minimalistic. A Detroit pizza is maximalistic. It's thicker crust. You know, it's a lot of everything. It goes against all the things that I would have been on paper opposed to until I tasted one. And then all those rules just went out the window and I went, oh my God, there's a better way of doing pizza than I knew about. And then I started working on my own version of it because I got invited to be a consultant for a restaurant in Texas that wanted to put a Detroit pizza on the menu, and it wasn't a pizza restaurant. And so he was going to have to re-engineer the whole kitchen to be able to include a pizza on it just as a first course. It wasn't going to be the main item there, but he wanted to have one as good as the Detroit pizza that he had had in a restaurant in Telluride, Colorado called the Brown Dog. And Jeff Smokovich is the owner of that. I've met him at the pizza expos, and Jeff is kind of one of the rock stars of this style of pizza. He does a killer version. But I hadn't had his pizza when I was asked to create, you know, a version for this guy. And so we just started working on it. And I said, well, how will I know when I've achieved, you know, one that matches Jeff's pizza? And he said, well, he said, here's what I look for. He said, I'm looking for a wow factor. I go for me, what excites me is when something wows me. And so I said, so my job is to get you to wow. And he said, exactly. And when I get the wow, you'll know it. And we spent a week working on different variations and things. And we finally, the breakthrough came when we decided to try, and it was at the suggestion of one of his managers, tried putting half of the cheese on the dough before we let the dough rise in the pan, because it takes the dough 3 to 4 hours to rise after you fill the pan with it to get it to be just right. And so we put half the cheese on before the rise, and then the other half right before we baked it. And something magical happened in the dough. By doing that, it not only tenderized the dough, kind of made it and embedded the cheese. It gave it a flavoring character that we weren't getting any other way. And it actually, after we kind of fine-tuned it, in my opinion, surpassed even the best Detroit pizzas I've had anywhere else, including Jeff's, which I later had at Pizza Expo, and it was really, really good. But I think this little trick that we added, which is totally original to the book, is my sort of addition to the lexicon of making these style of pizzas, and that's what gave me the idea for writing a book about it. So the book then, you know, is sort of a celebration of not only Detroit style pizzas, but other types of pizzas that are baked in pans, like focaccia, Sicilian style, schiacciata, which is basically Tuscan focaccia, and even a grandma pie, which has, you know, been around forever in New York, but is really just simply a pizza baked in a pan, like a Sicilian pie, but slightly different. And so the book kind of celebrates all of those styles of pizza baked in the pan. But the star of the book really is, and I'm not even calling them Detroit style. I'm referring them as Detroit style pizzas, but we're calling them deep pan pizzas. Deep pan as opposed to deep dish, which is the Chicago style. And we're not even touching Chicago style in the book because that's a whole different entity altogether. It's more like it's very good, but it's more like a casserole and a pastry. It's the crust is more pastry-like. I felt that needed a book of its own. So the deep pan pizzas are, for me, the emerging star in this category. We're doing another category that's emerging big, and you'll, over the next couple of years, will become very big, is Roman style, which is like a focaccia, baked in a pan, thicker crust than a pizza, but all again, the emphasis is on the quality of that crust, and it needs to be large, open holes, airy, very ciabatta-like, that when you bite into it, has a crackle to it that just, again, in addition to the wonderful flavor, gives you a type of pleasure just when you hear the sound of the crust itself. And all these pieces come together. So it just goes to show that there's many ways to make pizza and many ways to deliver flavor and pleasure to people. And I just like to zero in on sort of the characteristics that really make it happen. And my goal now is to bring everybody to that moment of wow?
Well, I made it. I made the dough. I did the Levan version of the dough on Saturday, and I cheated up a little bit because I have a starter on my counter. So I used some of that to help give it a little bit of a goose and put it in the cooler for a couple of days. And then so I followed the procedure just so, because this is a new kind of pizza to me. So I did, you know, the first thing is I weighed the amount of dough you recommended for a 10-inch pan. And I got it in there, and so it was like 270 grams for a 10-inch pan. And I'm pushing it around, and I'm thinking, there's just no way this is going to work. So I think, that's all right. Let's
stick with it. Yeah.
Go through it first. Let's see what happens. He did this for a reason.
I appreciate and it.
So I put it in a big Ziploc bag so it wouldn't dry out, and let it proof over hours, put the cheese on top. As it's sitting there, pepperoni, more cheese, and son of a gun, that dough really rose. And I must admit, I have a convection oven, so I sort of, and I know better than this, I shouldn't have done it. I backed off on the heat a little bit. I went to 450.
That's right. You did the right
500. Well, I should have gone high because I didn't, the crust was fine. And if you were to look at it, you had a nice bake. It had a good, maybe, eighth of an inch of good crust, but I like extremes in my bread and especially in my crust. Yeah. So I wanted a more profound crunch and crack. But the family adored it. It disappeared, and of course, because I'm in Oregon, the Wisconsin brick cheese is don't even bother looking for it. Right. I just used, instead of buying shredded mozzarella, I bought a round of it. It wasn't the buffalo milk. It was just commercial stuff. But you know, that big brick of, well, wrong, I'm going to confuse people. That block of mozzarella cheese cut into small squares has a different melty texture.
That's right.
Than shredded mozzarella. So I would recommend do away with shredded mozzarella. It's horrible.
For this style of pizza, the reason we suggest cutting them into cubes instead of shredding it, into threads, is that it takes about 15 to 18 minutes to bake. And at about 475 to 500 degrees, depending on your oven. It sounds like in your oven, you may want to go to 475, let's say, with your convection. But in that amount of time, the shredded cheese will not only melt and caramelize, but it'll probably carbonize. We don't want to burn it. Whereas if you start with the larger cubes, it takes longer for it to melt and spread so you don't burn it. And that's the practical reason for doing it. Let me throw one more trick at you for the next time you do these, because the cheese is hard to find. Brick cheese is very hard to find. And brick cheese is a delicious cheese. It's got a nice little tang to it. It's kind of a cross between cheddar and Swiss and a few other. But what it's really like, and I found this out by talking to one of the companies that makes it, and the company also makes another cheese that everybody can get called Munster cheese. Mm. And I hadn't thought about Munster and brick being similar, but they are. And so he suggested, tell people if they can't find the brick, you know, they can always use the blends of mozzarella and other cheeses. I like to use mozzarella, fontina, or a little bit of cheddar for the tanginess. But he said, but have them use Munster instead, and they'll get pretty much the same functionality that they would from the brick. And so I've switched over and I've started using Munster cheese more and more, and I'm totally in love with it. And prior to that, I was just sort of so-so about Munster cheese. I liked it, but it wasn't my favorite. But on this pizza, it works really good. So if you get a chance, try that and tell me what you think.
I will look for that. And my other recommendation to you, and I don't think I can get it here because I haven't seen it, it's hard to find also, is Fontanella, which melts like a dream. It is. Ooh. God, it's so good.
So Fontanella is different from Fontina?
Yes. I'm not entirely sure how it is, but it's similar. Fontanelle is a little softer, and it just has a lower melting point. And I first discovered this melting point making an open faced melted cheese and turkey sandwich, and it just under the salamander melted. And this is incredible! But the flavor. Especially the compatibility with the nice bread and turkey breast and avocado and this cheese. Oh, my goodness. This is just,
well, there you go.
So it was great. Yeah, so
I can almost taste that as you're describing it. And I think part of what makes those cheeses like that so good is the butterfat that's in there, you know, that starts to melt out. And so, yeah, so you don't want to use, if you're using mozzarella, you don't want to use the low-fat mozzarella. Use the full-fat mozzarella. But these other cheeses, like you just described, even have a higher concentration because they're aged a little bit.
So, you know, we're talking about sandwiches, and you make the observation in your book that sometimes for inspiration and innovation, you think about what sandwich do I like and how can I just make that a pizza. So you came up with a Reuben pizza, and I told this to my wife. She said, oh my gosh, that sounds so good. And also the spaghetti and meatballs pizza. And she's like, you have to make that. What are you talking about? So, so we're gonna go with that. But the thing that impressed me the most was just a whole new thinking into what pizza can be. And so you have to time, you have to plan. This is not a roll the dough out and slap it in the oven kind of a pizza, but it is. And I got to tell you, I was thinking, how in the world do restaurants respond to this? How do you know how many doughs to have out ready and waiting? This is sounds like a.
That's a really good question. And let me return back to that restaurant in Texas to complete that story, because it kind of speaks to that. We kind of came up with the recipe, the system, everything by the end of that week that we were working on it. And that was in the end of June. And then I returned home to North Carolina, and he said, we're going to start. The challenge now for my restaurant is, how are we going to integrate it into our system? Because all we have, we don't have a pizza oven. We just have an under the range Wolf oven. And I said, that's all you need, you know, but he says we use that for other things too. I said, well, we know what temperature we have to be. If you can just keep that temperature in place. And then we talked about staging the pizzas, setting them up, starting a day ahead, getting, you know, his goal at first was to make 60 a day in the restaurant and sell 60 as an appetizer course, and not take anything else off the menu, but just have it be a bonus, you know, a plus to the menu. And he said, if I can do 60 a day, I'll be very happy. So I said, well, we'll set it up for 60, knowing that they'll stay in the refrigerator for up to 3 or 4 days. If you don't use them, you can pull them out 3 days later, and they're still just as good because the refrigerator will stop the fermentation. And so he started with 60. But it took him, I think it wasn't until the end of October that he put it on the menu. It took them 3 months to train the staff, to get a flow and a system in place. And then as soon as they started introducing it to the menu, they took off, and the 60 were not enough. And when I called them a few weeks after he launched it, and I said, well, how's it going? He said, oh my God, we've created a monster. We're selling 120 a day instead of 60. He said, I can't keep up. And he said, but that's a good problem to have, and we're going to solve it, you know? So anyway, but it did take a month of planning, you know, because he didn't want to come out prematurely and then screw it up, you know? So he did a very smart thing. And got trained his staff to be able to rotate them. He knew, you know, how many hours ahead to take them out. He got to where he could predict pretty much how many would sell. And then you pull them out, you know, a few hours, 4 hours before you're actually planning to bake them. If it looks like it's a slow night and you're not going to use them all, you can put them back in the fridge and slow them down again. So it's a very forgiving pizza dough itself. Bread dough can be very forgiving. There are things that, you know, if you over ferment something, it's hard to go back, but you can always catch things and arrest the fermentation, so to speak. We call it retard the dough by holding it back by using colder temperatures like refrigeration. And he's got it all dialed in now.
All right. So we've talked about all the things that are possible and lots of ideas of what can happen with the pizza. So let's ask the inverse. Is there something that simply should never go on a pizza?
That's a good question.
By the way, you have the Hawaiian pizza in your book. That's on social media. That's lots of people are like showing pineapple on pizza. Like, get out.
Yeah, I know. It's very controversial, and I think that's because it's, again, people, you know, can easily fall into what I, you know, the purist rule. Like, you know, if this is something, you know, doesn't look right, or it's not what I grew up with, or it doesn't sound right. And it's important to know with the Hawaiian pizza that Hawaiian pizza didn't come from Hawaii. It started in Canada with a guy who had worked in Chinese restaurants, an not a Chinese guy, but, you know, just a Hali, who was working in a restaurant and had his own. And he liked the Asian method of sweet and spicy and sweet and savory, that combination. And he was making pizzas in his restaurant, and he decided to try to use that principle. And so he married pineapple with Canadian bacon as the sweet savory blend. And he but because of the pineapple, he just gave it the name Hawaiian pizza. And it became popular, and it caught on. And so a lot of people thought it came out from Hawaii, and it's, you know, some kind of a bastardization of something. It was just using the principles that we were just talking about, of realizing that pizza is just a flavor delivery system, and the winner is the guy who can deliver the most flavor to the customer. And so I had, you know, there's all these rules that the pizza makers have about what you can and can't do. In Italy, there's the Neapolitan VPN rules, where you have to use their flour. It has to be using tomatoes that were grown in the soil of Mount Vesuvius, you know, San Marzano tomatoes. You have to use pure buffalo mozzarella. I mean, and these are the rules if you want to call your pizza a true Neapolitan pizza. So we call those, I call those the pizza police rules, because the rules have a valid purpose to protect and preserve a methodology that could be totally lost if you don't have a sort of a standard template for it. I get that. But what happened was, a lot of pizzerias were opening in the United States, and people were getting certified in the VPN system, and they would make a big fuss about it. And we bring our flour over from Italy and blah, blah, blah. And the pizzas were not memorable. They were just okay. They were good pizzas, because the people who were making them had not mastered the craft of making pizzas yet. There's only a few people in the United States that make a killer Neapolitan pizza at the same level that you could get in Naples. One of them is Spaccanopoli in Chicago, for instance. The guy is committed, totally passionate about it. There's places in New York City like Queste, where the guy is from Naples, so he's doing the real deal. And there are a few other places that have committed. But most people just sort of did the quick American thing. You know, I read it, I see how to do it, I'm doing it, you know. And then they were surprised that people didn't fall in love with it the way they did with the Naples pizzas. So I decided that there's the pizza police rules, and then there is a higher rule. And I call the higher rule the flavor rule. And the flavor rule is flavor rules. And so when people write to me and say, can I do this on my pizza? Am I allowed? You know, I like cheese on my clam pizza, but they say in Italy that you can't put, you know, fish and cheese together. So my question back to them is, does it work? Do you like it? Oh, yeah, I love it. Does it deliver flavor? Yeah. I said, well, then let's appeal to the higher rule, the flavor rule, and we'll walk away from the pizza police rule and just do it because it meets the criteria of the flavor rule, that is, flavor rules. And that's been governing me ever since. So I don't think there's hardly anything you can't do on a pizza unless it violates the flavor rule. So if you put ingredients that don't work, it won't take you long to figure that out. You try to make a peanut butter and jelly pizza, and the jelly all runs off the pizza, and, you know, and it burns, and all, you know that you violated some rules there. You know, would the flavors work? Maybe they would, but maybe not in that form. So the Hawaiian pizza, I think, you know, there's some versions of it out there now. Nancy Silverton does one at Pizzeria Mozza in L.A., which is probably one of the top three pizzerias in America, in my opinion. And we did it. I did a video with her on my website, Pizza Quest, where we actually show us eating her version of the Hawaiian pizza. And it is so beautiful and so artistically done. And the quality of the meat and the quality of, and she's using fresh pineapple that she's carved herself. And I mean, it's on a different level. So you eat that and you go, I don't care if everybody thinks I'm crazy, you know, and the people who don't like Hawaiian pizza are going to vilify me. This pizza is so good, I'll stand and defend it. You know, I've got its back, you know, and that's how I feel about a lot of things. So it really comes down to execution and quality and flavor more than it is to sort of rules. So I'm trying to think if there's any other sort of specific things that I wouldn't put. I don't have really a list of things that I say you can't do on a pizza, because I think you have to try it. Well, one more thing on that. Wolfgang Puck, about 35 years ago at Spago, introduced the idea of sort of a global pizza. And every night he had a wonderful pizza maker there named Ed Ledoux, who just had grasped intuitively that pizza was just dough with something on it So why does the something on it have to be Italian? Why can't it be Asian? Why can't it be South American? Why can't it be stuff fresh from the farmer's market? And every day he'd go to the market and see what the fresh ingredients were, and he'd create toppings and put on the menu two pizzas that night at Spago, which was a high-end restaurant, and pizzas were a starter course. But it kind of helped put Spago on the map. These pizzas were they were like breakthrough pizzas because he was putting flavors on top of a very good crust that really got people excited. And by the time he left Spago to open his own pizzeria, Ed had also worked for California Pizza Kitchen and developed pizzas for them. He had developed over 250 different kinds of pizzas, pizza topping ideas, you know, and was continuing, you know, and then unfortunately he sadly died at a young age before he had a chance to kind of like go all the way and fulfill, you know, probably had 1,000 different pizzas in him that he could have done. But it goes back to that principle of dough with something on it does not have to be specifically Italian or be owned. Pizzas exist in every culture under different names. You know, in India, they have naan bread, right? What is naan bread? It's dough and usually with some garlic butter or some onion, some, you know, it could have stuff in it or on top of it, folded over. It's basically Indian pizza. A quesadilla is a Tex-Mex pizza. A grilled cheese sandwich is, in a sense, kind of like a variation of a pizza. That's a sandwich, which is a cousin of a pizza. Instead of dough with something on it, it's dough with something in it. But a grilled cheese sandwich is about as close to a Detroit pizza as, you know, as you're going to get, unless you make a Detroit pizza yourself. So I think that the flavor rule can help us steer through the question of what you can't do on a pizza.
I think that's a spectacular answer.
Cool. I'm proud of that idea of the flavor rule. I should probably trademark
it. No, it's a really good idea. And one of the things you did bring up, and I want to just talk on this one more point, because we've talked a little bit about making home bakers give no, not making giving home bakers an opportunity and home cooks a chance for success. Because I anybody who's baking and cooking at home wants the thing they're making or baking to come out well. I mean, that just is obvious. So anybody who writes a cookbook is setting down some set of rules. And the person who doesn't know anything about this craft is going to read the recipe and say, these are the rules. And so if I were to take up woodworking, which I understand is to transform this piece of wood into something gorgeous, well, I'm not going to do good at it because I that's just not my thing. So I recognize the feeling of subordination to the words on a page, but fundamentally, it's words on a page. We assume that the person who wrote them knows what he or she is doing, and in some cases, cookbook authors don't know what they're doing. So that's one of the places where failure happens, is somebody follows the recipe was bad to begin with, and they'll see, I told you I can't cook. So we have the Neapolitans and these very strict rules about you can't, it must have this potato or this tomato grown on the west side of the mountain, picked at the full moon on the summer. Like, shut up. So yeah, right. there's a lot of fear of failure in home cooks and bakers. And
yeah.
What suggestions, what advice do you have for people listening to suspend that trepidation and dive in? How can we, what words of advice, to as much as we can control it, can we give people to ensure they can succeed?
Well, that's a good question. I think that number one, you know, cooking of any type, baking, cooking, making pizzas, you know, you can say that all of these fall in a category that we could call craft. It's a craft. And woodworking, they're all crafts. And craft, getting good at craft does require repetition, does require practice, and it does require mastering guidelines and principles and instructions before you can go out and improvise and do all sorts of, you know, unique sort of out of the box ideas. You need to know how to work within the box. And it's not because there's anything wrong with being creative. It's that until you've mastered the craft itself, it's hard to know. It's hard to go beyond it. It's hard to transcend the craft if you haven't yet mastered it. So the first thing is to always, you know, always know that failure is part of the learning process. And so you always get a redo. That's a nice thing about cooking, is the next day you can do it again. Bread making is a very cheap way of getting into it because it's much less expensive than cooking with steak and foie gras and all sorts of fancy ingredients. But until you've failed a few times, you really haven't really succeeded because you don't know what the parameters and the boundaries can be. So Tony Gemignani, who is the owner of some amazingly popular pizzerias around the country, and he's the world champion. He's probably America's the Mozart of pizza, I call him, who can work in any style of pizza. His pizzeria in San Francisco called Tony's Pizzeria, Tony's Neapolitan Pizza or something like that. He's got places in Las Vegas called Pizza Rock, and he's opening pizzerias all over the place. We did some videos with him, and on the pizza box itself, if you just, you know, want to take a pizza home with you or take your leftovers home in a box, printed on the box, it has the words, respect the craft. He said that's his mantra, respect the craft. He spent years and years developing and perfecting his craft, and he does trade, and he has a school, and he teaches people, you know, how to make pizzas. He says, but you have to be willing to, you know, pay the price, dude, pay your dues in learning the craft itself. And some people learn it faster than others, but if you stick with it, you can always learn it. So that's number one, is just stick with it and realize, yes, the guidelines and the recipes are structure to help you get to the point where you can do things without using the recipes. A lot of people were born in Italy. They don't need recipes to cook. They grew up learning how to cook. They know how to, if they see 12 ingredients, they know how to turn them into something really good. But most people who are learning how to cook need to follow the instructions because they'll get you there. And then at a certain point, you can maybe let go of that. You don't have to be rigidly tied to them. People who are so tied to their recipes that they can't entertain the idea of a little tweak here and there, then they become, dogmatic cooks, to where they, you know, they can't, they're not free to enjoy the spirit of cooking because they're so tied to the dogma of cooking. And so, but it doesn't happen overnight. It's practice. But it's not a long learning curve. It's just doing it, you know, a few times a week. And before you know, within a couple of weeks, you know, you're suddenly in a different place. So don't be afraid of failure. Don't throw away your failures necessarily. Not everything is inedible. If you've ruined it, if you burned it, or if put way too much salt, you may have to toss it. But, you know, a lot of those things can be salvaged. But if not, you know, then just start again and just chalk it up to a learning lesson. Wasn't it Edison who said that it took him over 1,000 tries to get the light bulb, and when they asked him if he was discouraged, he said, "No, each time I just told myself that that I know one more way of how not to make the light bulb, you know, until he knew he was going to get there eventually." So okay, so that's number one, and number two is read recipes thoroughly. So if you know how to cook a little bit, they're the most dangerous ones, are the people who do know how to cook a little bit and they look at a recipe and they don't really read it carefully and they just kind of scan and go, "Oh, I got it. I can do it." And they may be missing an important instruction in the recipe. So read the recipe. And then the final thing I would advise, and this is what every culinary student at my school, at Johnson & Wales, as well as any culinary school, the first thing they learn is the principle of mise en place, which means everything in its place. And that means, you know, weigh or scale your ingredients, organize your work area, and get really organized. Mise en place really just means get organized. And I think that the way to do that is first read the recipe all the way through, then gather your ingredients, set them up, and then, you know, then begin the process rather than just diving in and then going, "Oh yeah, where's that garlic powder? Or where did I put the oregano?" You know, get everything out there when you first start and you'll be much more organized and make less errors.
And be faster.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that was probably the answer I would have given, but it has more weight coming from you. So thank you so much for that.
Well, you're a cook, you know the same things that I know, which is, you know, it all starts with mise en place, you know, in cooking. Yeah.
Well, and so, and I'm going to contribute to that there are two kinds of mise en place of the physical stuff and mise en place of the thoughts. You have to have your mind in order to have your ingredients in order.
Yes. Well said. And I, you know, and I'm glad you said that because, again, there is the physical mise en place, but if you haven't, if you haven't focused yourself, if your mind is scattered all over the place, then,
you know, cannot succeed.
Yeah. That's a recipe for disaster. Yeah.
True enough. All right. Well, since this is a cooking show, the last part is a short answer question, sort of like they do on Inside the Actors Studio.
Yeah, right.
So I've changed the questions, but it's still in the same style. Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
Sour.
What's your favorite food?
I would say a Caesar salad is my single favorite dish.
What's your least favorite food?
I've had less of them. It used to be beets, but now I've learned to love beets. So I'm trying to, if I have a least favorite food, overcooked green beans.
Oh, okay. What gets you excited?
The discovery process. I'll just call it that, the discovery process when it comes to cooking.
Hmm. What turns you off?
People who are know-it-alls.
What sound do you love?
The sound of crust.
Yes. I expected that. I really did. I'm glad you didn't just...
That was a lob, a softball lob. Yeah.
Well, in your case, it was. What sound do you hate?
It's not a sound. It's a phrase. I can't do this. Qualify that. What sound do I hate the most? Whining. The sound of whining.
Oh, fair enough. What is your favorite food indulgence?
I think it's a good question. It changes all the time. I'll say chocolate and cherries together.
Oh, that's a good one. Yes. Nicely. Well played.
I have to sneak that one in when no one's looking.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for making time to come on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast today.
Well, Dan, it's been such a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we have a chance to continue the conversation in the future.
I do, too. So the book we talked about is your book, Perfect Pan Pizza, and I'll have a link for that on today's show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/38. Do you have a social media presence or a website you want to give to people to follow you?
Yeah. I would love for folks to check out my own website, pizzaquest.com. You can just go to pizzaquest.com. It'll lead you to the site. And we've got videos where I've interviewed and done demos with world famous pizza makers, including Nancy Silverton and Tony Gemignani. And we do guest columns and all sorts of cool things. And it's, even though it's called Pizza Quest, the sub name of the sort of the catchphrase is, a journey of self-discovery through pizza. So I'd love for people to check it out.
Well, that has become kind of a theme because it says self-discovery in the subtitle on Bread Upon the Waters,
right.
Brother Juniper's Slow Rise of the Person and the Bread. So it seems you have very well found your niche in the world. And like I said, I've been a big fan and just got to work on that semolina bread.
Well, let's work on that one together. Because I want to hear that wow moment from you when we nail it.
There was one, and I'm looking for it, and I can't find it, of course, because I want to find it. There was something else. It was I think I tried the Struan once at the Tallahassee restaurant, but we made another one. It was kind of sweet, molassesy maybe.
Well, there's one. I don't use molasses in Struan, although you could. But the one that I use molasses in is the Anadama bread.
That's the one. Man, is that good?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And that's a traditional bread. I mean, it's my version, but it's really a East Coast, a New England bread.
Everyone who tried it was they took a bite and they stopped and they like big eye and they go, oh my gosh,
love it. Glad to hear that.
Oh, it was a big hit. So yeah, that was good.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. Some of the things you've said today, about not only the breads, but how some of these words have touched you mean a lot to me hearing it. And it makes me feel like it was worth the effort to sit there at the keyboard and write them out.
Well, I'm glad you did. I feel a better person for it. So
thank you so much, Dan. Onward. Well, how about if I close with what I call the Baker's Blessing, which I often sign when people ask me to sign their book. I write this, what I call the Baker's Blessing, which I made up, of course. It's not the Baker's Blessing, but since I'm a baker and I can give blessings, I came up with one, and it is, may your crust be crisp and your bread always rise. Amen.
Lovely. Well, that's a great way to close.
Thanks.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. You can find a link to the Perfect Pan Pizza book, as well as Peter's other books I mentioned, at the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/38, as well as links to the affiliates mentioned and an Amazon page for Detroit Pan Pizza gear. After you've listened to all the Culinary Libertarian podcasts, you'll be wanting more podcasts. Eye on 2020 podcast, found on the eyeontheempire.com webpage, is a libertarian podcast to show the principles of liberty and how liberty and less, at least, government is more empowering than more government. Check out Eye on 2020, a podcast on Anchor, and let host Ray Eden share his insights with you. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.